or a poet, stare at those morning clouds. But I tell you this, that you will have found out the truth of the last tree and the topmost cloud before the truth about me. You will understand the sea, and I shall be still a riddle. You shall know what the stars are and know not what I am. Since the beginning of the world, all men have hunted me like a wolf, kings and sages and poets and lawgivers, all the churches and all the philosophies. But I have never been caught yet, and the skies will fall in the time I turn to bay. I have given them a good run for their money, and I will now. Before one of them could move, the monstrous man had swung himself like some huge orangutan over the balustrade of the balcony. Yet before he dropped, he pulled himself up again as on a horizontal bar, and thrusting his great chin over the edge of the balcony, said solemnly, "There's one thing I'll tell you, though, about who I am. I am the man in the dark room who made you all policemen." With that, he fell from the balcony, bouncing on the stones below like a great ball of India rubber, and went bounding off toward the corner of the Alhambra, where he hailed a hansom cab and sprang inside it. The six detectives had been standing thunderstruck and livid in the light of his last assertion. But when he disappeared into the cab, Syme's practical senses returned to him, and leaping over the balcony so recklessly as almost to break his legs, he called another cab. He and Bull sprang into the cab together, the professor and the inspector into another, while the secretary and the late Gogol scrambled into a third, just in time to pursue the flying Syme, who was pursuing the flying president. Sunday led them a wild chase towards the northwest. His cabman, evidently under the influence of more than common inducements, urging the horse at breakneck speed. But Syme was in no mood for delicacies, and he stood up in his own cab, shouting, "Stop, thief!" until the crowds ran along beside his cab, and policemen began to stop and ask questions. All this had its influence upon the president's cabman, who began to look dubious and to slow down to a trot. He opened the trap to talk reasonably to his fare, and in so doing let the long whip droop over the front of the cab. Sunday leaned forward, seized it, and jerked it violently out of the man's hand. Then, standing up in front of the cab himself, he lashed the horse and roared aloud so that they went down the streets like a flying storm. Through street after street and square after square went whirling this preposterous vehicle, in which the fare was urging the horse and the driver trying desperately to stop it. The other three cabs came after it, if the phrase be permissible of a cab, like panting hounds. Shops and streets shot by like rattling arrows. At the highest ecstasy of speed, Sunday turned round on the splashboard where he stood, and sticking his great grinning head out of the cab, with white hair whistling in the wind, he made a horrible face at his pursuers, like some colossal urchin. Then, raising his right hand swiftly, he flung a ball of paper in Syme's face and vanished. Syme caught the thing while instinctively warding it off, and discovered that it consisted of two crumpled papers. One was addressed to himself and the other to Dr. Bull, with a very long, and it is to be feared partly ironical, string of letters after his name. Dr. Bull's address was, at any rate, considerably longer than his communication, for the communication consisted entirely of the words, "What about Martin Tupper now?" "What does the old maniac mean?" asked Bull, staring at the words. "What does yours say, Syme?" Syme's message was, at any rate, longer, and ran as follows: "No one would regret anything in the nature of an interference by the Archdeacon more than I. I trust it will not come to that. But for the last time, where are your galoshes? The thing is too bad, especially after what Uncle said." The president's cabman seemed to be regaining some control over his horse, and the pursuers gained a little as they swept round into the Edgware Road, and here there occurred what seemed to the Allies a providential stoppage. Traffic of every kind was swerving to right or left, or stopping, for down the long road was coming the unmistakable roar announcing the fire engine, which in a few seconds went by like a brazen thunderbolt. But quick as it went by, Sunday had bounded out of his cab, sprung at the fire engine, caught it, slung himself onto it, and was seen as he disappeared in the noisy distance, talking to the astonished firemen with explanatory gestures. After him, howled Syme, he can't go astray now. There's no mistaking a fire engine. The three cabmen, who had been stunned for a moment, whipped up their horses and slightly decreased the distance between themselves and their disappearing prey. The president acknowledged this proximity by coming to the back of the car, bowing repeatedly, kissing his hand, and finally flinging a neatly folded note into the bosom of Inspector Ratcliffe. When that gentleman opened it, not without impatience, he found it contained the words, "Fly at once. The truth about your trouser stretchers is known. A friend." The fire engine had struck still farther to the north into a region that they did not recognize, and as it ran by a line of high railings shadowed with trees, the six friends were startled but somewhat relieved to see the president leap from the fire engine, though whether through another whim or the increasing protest of his entertainers they could not see. Before the three cabs, however, could reach up to the spot, he had gone up the high railings like a huge gray cat, tossed himself over, and vanished in a darkness of leaves. Syme, with a furious gesture, stopped his cab, jumped out, and sprang also to the escalade. When he had one leg over the fence and his friends were following, he turned a face on them, which shone quite pale in the shadow. "What place can this be?" he asked. "Can it be the old devil's house? I've heard he has a house in North London." "All the better," said the secretary grimly, planting a foot in a foothold. "We shall find him at home." "No, but it isn't that," said Syme, knitting his brows. "I hear the most horrible noises, like devils laughing and sneezing and blowing their devilish noses." "His dog's barking, of course," said the secretary. "Why not say his black beetle's barking?" said Syme furiously. "Snail's barking, geranium's barking. Did you ever hear a dog bark like that?" He held up his hand, and there came out of the thicket a long, growling roar that seemed to get under the skin and freeze the flesh, a low, thrilling roar that made a throbbing in the air all about them. "The dogs of Sunday would be no ordinary dogs," said Gogol, and shuddered. Syme had jumped down on the other side, but he still stood listening impatiently. "Well, listen to that," he said. "Is that a dog? Anybody's dog?" There broke upon their ear a hoarse screaming as of things protesting and clamoring in sudden pain, and then far off like an echo what sounded like a long nasal trumpet. "Well, his house ought to be hell," said the secretary, "and if it is hell, I'm going in." And he sprang over the tall railings almost with one swing. The others followed. They broke through a tangle of plants and shrubs and came out on an open path. Nothing was in sight, but Dr. Bull suddenly struck his hands together. "Why, you asses," he cried, "it's the zoo." As they were looking round wildly for any trace of their wild quarry, a keeper in uniform came running along the path with a man in plain clothes. "Has it come this way?" gasped the keeper. "Has what?" asked Syme. "The elephant," cried the keeper. "An elephant has gone mad and run away." "He has run away with an old gentleman," said the other stranger breathlessly, "a poor old gentleman with white hair." "What sort of old gentleman?" asked Syme with great curiosity. "A very large and fat old gentleman in light gray clothes," said the keeper eagerly. "Well," said Syme, "if he's that particular kind of old gentleman, if you're quite sure that he's a large and fat old gentleman in gray clothes, you may take my word for it that the elephant has not run away with him. He has run away with the elephant. The elephant is not made by God that could run away with him if he did not consent to the elopement. And by thunder, there he is." There was no doubt about it this time. Clean across the space of grass, about 200 yards away, with a crowd screaming and scampering vainly at his heels, went a huge gray elephant at an awful stride, with his trunk thrown out as rigid as a ship's bowsprit, and trumpeting like the trumpet of doom. On the back of the bellowing and plunging animal sat President Sunday with all the placidity of a sultan, but goading the animal to a furious speed with some sharp object in his hand. "Stop him," screamed the populace. "He'll be out of the gate." "Stop a landslide," said the keeper. "He is out of that gate." And even as he spoke, a final crash and roar of terror announced that the great gray elephant had broken out of the gates of the zoological gardens and was careening down Albany Street like a new and swift sort of omnibus. "Great Lord," cried Bull, "I never knew an elephant could go so fast. Well, it must be hansom cabs again if we are to keep him in sight." As they raced along to the gate out of which the elephant had vanished, Syme felt a glaring panorama of the strange animals in the cages which they passed. Afterwards, he thought it queer that he should have seen them so clearly. He remembered especially seeing pelicans with their preposterous pendant throats. He wondered why the pelican was the symbol of charity, except it was that it wanted a good deal of charity to admire a pelican. He remembered a hornbill, which was simply a huge yellow beak with a small bird tied on behind it. The whole gave him a sensation, the vividness of which he could not explain, that nature was always making quite mysterious jokes. Sunday had told them that they would understand him when they had understood the stars. He wondered whether even the archangels understood the hornbill. The six unhappy detectives swung themselves into cabs and followed the elephant, sharing the terror which he spread through the long stretch of the streets. This time Sunday did not turn round, but offered them the solid stretch of his unconscious back, which maddened them, if possible, more than his previous mockeries. Just before they came to Baker Street, however, he was seen to throw something far up into the air, as a boy does a ball, meaning to catch it again. But at their rate of racing, it fell far behind, just by the cab containing Gogo, and in faint hope of a clue or for some impulse unexplainable, he stopped his cab so as to pick it up. It was addressed to himself and was quite a bulky parcel. On examination, however, its bulk was found to consist of 33 pieces of paper of no value wrapped one around the other. When the last covering was torn away, it reduced itself to a small slip of paper on which was written, "The word, I fancy, should be pink." The man once known as Gogol said nothing, but the movements of his hands and feet were like those of a man urging a horse to renewed efforts. Through street after street, through district after district, went the prodigy of the flying elephant, calling crowds to every window and driving the traffic left and right. And still through all this insane publicity, the three cabs toiled after it, until they came to be regarded as part of a procession, and perhaps the advertisement of a circus. They went at such a rate that distances were shortened beyond belief, and Symes saw the Albert Hall in Kensington, when he thought that he was still in Paddington. The animal's pace was even more fast and free through the empty, aristocratic streets of South Kensington, and he finally headed towards that part of the skyline where the enormous wheel of Earl's Court stood up in the sky. The wheel grew larger and larger till it filled heaven like the wheel of stars. The beast outstripped the cabs. They lost him round several corners, and when they came to one of the gates of the Earl's Court Exhibition, they found themselves finally blocked. In front of them was an enormous crowd. In the midst of it was an enormous elephant, heaving and shuddering as such shapeless creatures do. But the president had disappeared. "Where has he gone to?" asked Syme, slipping to the ground. "Gentlemen rushed into the exhibition, sir," said an official in a dazed manner. Then he added in an injured voice, "Funny gentleman, sir. Asked me to hold his horse and gave me this." He held out with distaste a piece of folded paper addressed to the secretary of the Central Anarchist Council. The secretary, raging, rent it open and found written inside it, "When the herring runs a mile, let the secretary smile. When the herring tries to fly, let the secretary die." Rustic proverb. "Why, the eternal crickies," began the secretary, "did you let the man in? Do people commonly come to you exhibition riding on mad elephants? Do..." "Look out," shouted Syme suddenly. "Look over there." "Look at what?" asked the secretary savagely. "Look at the captive balloon," said Simon, pointed in a frenzy. "Why the blazes should I look at a captive balloon?" demanded the secretary. "What is there queer about a captive balloon?" "Nothing," said Syme, "except that it isn't captive." They all turned their eyes to where the balloon swung and swelled over the exhibition on a string like a child's balloon. A second afterwards, the string came in two just under the car, and the balloon, broken loose, floated away with the freedom of a soap bubble. 10,000 devils, shrieked the secretary. He's got into it. And he shook his fists at the sky. The balloon, borne by some chance wind, came right above them, and they could see the great white head of the president peering over the side and looking benevolently down on them. God bless my soul, said the professor with the elderly manner that he could never disconnect from his bleached beard and parchment face. God bless my soul. I seem to fancy that something fell on the top of my hat. He put up a trembling hand and took from that shelf a piece of twisted paper, which he opened absently only to find it inscribed with a true lover's knot and the words, Your beauty has not left me indifferent. From Little Snowdrop. There was a short silence, and then Syme said, biting his beard, I'm not beaten yet. The blasted thing must come down somewhere. Let's follow it. Chapter 14. The Six Philosophers. Across green fields and breaking through blooming hedges toiled six draggled detectives about 5 miles out of London. The optimist of the party had at first proposed that they should follow the balloon across South England in hansom cabs, but he was ultimately convinced of the persistent refusal of the balloon to follow the roads, and the still more persistent refusal of the cabman to follow the balloon. Consequently, the tireless, though exasperated travelers broke through black thickets and plowed through plowed fields till each was turned into a figure too outrageous to be mistaken for a tramp. Those green hills of Surrey saw the final collapse and tragedy of the admirable light gray suit in which Syme had set out from Saffron Park. His silk hat was broken over his nose by a swinging bough. His coattails were torn to the shoulder by arresting thorns. The clay of England was splashed up to his collar, but he still carried his yellow beard forward with a silent and furious determination, and his eyes were still fixed on that floating ball of gas, which, in the full flush of sunset, seemed colored like a sunset cloud. After all, he said, it is very beautiful. It is singularly and strangely beautiful, said the professor. I wish the beastly gas bag would burst. No, said Dr. Bull, I hope it won't. It might hurt the old boy. Hurt him, said the vindictive professor. Hurt him. Not as much as I'd hurt him if I could get up with him, little snowdrop. I don't want him hurt somehow, said Dr. Bull. What? Cried the secretary bitterly. Do you believe all that tale about his being our man in the dark room? Sunday would say he was anybody. I don't know whether I believe it or not, said Dr. Bull, but it isn't that that I mean. I can't wish old Sunday's balloon to burst because... Well, said Simon impatiently, because... Well, because he's so jolly like a balloon himself, said Dr. Bull desperately. I don't understand a word of all that idea of his being the same man who gave us all our blue cards. It seems to make everything nonsense, but I don't care who knows it. I always had a sympathy for old Sunday himself, wicked as he was. Just as if he was a bouncing baby. How can I explain what my queer sympathy was? It didn't prevent my fighting him like hell. Shall I make it clear if I say that I liked him because he was so fat? You will not, said the secretary. I've got it now, cried Bull. It was because he was so fat and so light, just like a balloon. We always think of fat people as heavy, but he could have danced against a sylph. I see now what I mean. Moderate strength is shown in violence. Supreme strength is shown in levity. It was like the old speculation that what would happen if an elephant could leap up in the sky like a grasshopper? Our elephant, said Syme, looking upwards, has leaped into the sky like a grasshopper. And somehow, concluded Bull, that's why I can't help liking old Sunday. No, it's not an admiration of force nor any silly thing like that. There is a kind of gaiety in the thing, as if he were bursting with some good news. Haven't you sometimes felt it on a spring day? You know, nature plays tricks, but somehow that day proves they are good-natured tricks. I never read the Bible myself, but that part they laugh at is literal truth. Why leap ye, ye high hills? The hills do leap, at least they try to. Why do I like Sunday? How can I tell you? Because he's such a bounder. There was a long silence, and then the secretary said in a